Welcome to another T-Rex Talk. Today we're taking this show on the road, driving in the car. I've never recorded a podcast in the car, so we'll see how this one turns out. If you've ever driven across Iowa, you will have noticed corn. Big, wide open country, completely open country for the most part. Little windbreaks of trees around the original farmhouses, and then just corn as far as the eye can see. So in this episode, we're going to talk about farming. We're going to talk about modern agriculture, because that's what we just saw in Iowa. But we're also going to talk about how things have changed, because we visited on this road trip the old family farm, which was established back in 1876. And that farmhouse, that little farm property right there, is like a time capsule. It's like a cross-section of American farm history, and I'll explain why in a minute. Now, this is kind of a strange topic for the T-Rex Arms podcast, except that as we talk about sustainment, as we talk about building community, as we talk about a whole bunch of things that we want to recover and get better at skill set-wise, food production is one of them. And as we talk about issues that have arisen in our day and our age, culturally, politically, economically, etc., agriculture is kind of a big one because everybody needs food. Right, guys?
Yeah.
Now, on this road trip, I took my family, and I also want to talk a little bit about family history. I think it is very important that not only do we talk about these things amongst one another, but we also talk about these things with our kids. And I wanted my children to be able to see this family farm and to see where their ancestors worked and what their ancestors built and what their ancestors did. So in this episode, I'm going to intercut some of a conversation that I had with the kids, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But let's talk about the modern agriculture for a moment.
Clara, what was your favorite thing in the farm?
Corn.
Corn? Corn was your favorite thing at the farm?
Yeah.
How much corn was there?
Thousands.
Thousands of plants of corn?
Yeah. Fields of corn.
Thousands of fields of corn is more like it.
The real reason that Iowa is basically nothing but corn and soybeans is because of farm subsidies. The United States government essentially pays farmers to grow certain crops. And even those crops that are not subsidized are affected by a lot of regulations. So when you look at modern American farming, you see some incredible technological advances, you see some chemical advances, you see some genetic advances, but you generally don't see these advances coming because of the demand of the free market. Everybody in American farming is to some extent working around a landscape that has been completely changed by United States government regulations or United States government subsidies and grants, or large private companies like the John Deere Tractor Company, which are also heavily affected by government policies. I'm not even going to go down the rabbit hole of Monsanto and Roundup and genetically modified seeds and patented genetic modifications to various plants, which enables these large corporations to seize the farms that get pollinated by their IP as it drifts across the Iowa landscape blown by the wind. That is a study for another day. Actually, that is a conversation that we should have with somebody who knows a lot more about that side of things. But just to sum up, our agricultural system has gone from being a very market-driven, family-based operation that focused very much on the consumer of food to a gigantic industrialized, commercialized, and essentially state-directed, almost institution, I would say. Because our Iowa family farm is still kind of involved in farming, we still get a number of farming periodicals. And so I read some articles in an issue of Corn and Soybean magazine. That in and of itself is kind of interesting. There's a magazine that talks only about two crops. It is a major, major agricultural magazine. And half of the ads were about improving yields through new tools or new seeds or new techniques that were available from certain companies that you could purchase them from. And the other half of the ads were about increasing yields and profits through better business activities, which I'm all about, except that most of them appear to be about applying for better grants, applying for different subsidies, a whole bunch of really artificial stuff. Every bit as artificial as some of the chemicals involved in growing those crops in the first place. So let's talk a little bit about what things looked like 150 years ago. In the 1870s, my great-great-grandfather John Magnus came over from Sweden and he worked on the railroad. He was the foreman on a particular line that was being built across Iowa, and when he got to a little stream, he said, "This is the spot. This is the place where I'm going to build a family farm." He wrote to his fiancée and called her over, and he began creating a homestead. And it was incredibly hard work.
And then inside the farmhouse, it's built very, very close to the railroad line. Do you know why?
Why?
Because John Magnus and his son Oscar really loved the railroad. John Magnus loved the railroad because he helped build that line. That was one of his jobs. And that being close to the railroad line was actually very helpful for them a couple of times. There were some blizzards, and it was incredibly cold, and the snow was everywhere. And they were running out of wood and coal to burn. And so what they would do is they would trade food to the engineers running the locomotives in exchange for coal. They would get some food, like some cornbread, and they'd put it in a bag on the end of a stick. And they'd hold the stick up next to where the trains were going to pass by. And the engineer would hold out his hand and he'd grab the bag as they were going by and get the food, the cornbread or whatever it was. And then he'd throw out a bucket full of coal. And the children would pick up the bucket full of coal and run inside, and that would be enough coal to keep them warm and cook some more food for the guys on the train. So if they hadn't been able to trade food for coal, I know at least one of the winters they probably would not have survived.
But why they want coal and not food?
Well, because they were farmers, so they had enough food to eat, but they did not have enough wood or coal to keep the fires burning to stay warm. They would have frozen to death if they didn't have something to burn in their stove.
But then they would die.
Well, they didn't give away all their food. They just traded some of their food. So does that sound like a pretty hard life, farming back then?
Yeah.
It was a whole lot of hard work to actually do the farming. And it was hard sometimes to even stay alive in the winters. But did they give up?
No.
Did they go back to Sweden?
No.
They stayed right there. And every year they worked a little harder and they built a little more stuff. And some years they lost some things. But slowly, slowly, they got more land plowed. They got more crops growing. They were able to build some more buildings, like some of those barns. They were able to finally build some more buildings, like the farmhouse, and build up a little bit bigger and a little bit better farm every year for almost 100 years. They stopped farming after almost 100 years, and all that stuff is still there. Are you glad that you got to go and see it?
Yeah.
When you look at this farm operation, you see a group of people working together and utilizing every resource that they had. Every building that they created still stands, even though it was repurposed to become something else. Inside of the machine shop, you can see really old stuff, like an ancient anvil that they used to turn railroad spikes into useful pieces of farming machinery, but also instruction manuals from stuff that was really, really up to date at the time. Now, I mentioned that this farm is essentially a time capsule because it is no longer technically in operation. The land that goes with the farm is still being farmed, but not by us, not by anyone in our family. It's all been leased out to one of, I think, 3 ginormous corn planting and harvesting operations that essentially run all of the land and keep it all under crops as far as the eye can see. Now, in many ways, there are some tremendous improvements that have been made to the way that farming is done. And you would probably point out, hey, Isaac, you love modern technology. You love better and bigger tools. You love mass production and more efficient production of stuff and time-saving equipment. And the answer is, I absolutely do. And I will be the first to admit that a lot of these modern technological, mechanical, chemical, and even genetic modifications to the corn growing process have resulted in way, way more corn per acre than was possible a few decades ago. It's almost unbelievable how much the yields have grown. But on the other hand, I would bet that the amount of food per acre has gone way, way, way down. And I'm just absolutely confident that nutrition per acre has fallen considerably from the old days. In the old days, and not that long ago, even as recently as the 60s and 70s, when my dad was working on this farm in the summertime, it was an incredibly diverse place. They grew corn, yes. I believe they grew soybeans on occasion. They rotated crops a lot. They had tremendous amounts of different operations going on. They had turkeys, they had pigs, they had beef cattle, and at different times they had milk cows. And so they were a very diversified farm that could not only do a bunch of different things dependent on the season, dependent on what weather was doing, but also depending on what the market needed. And not just the faraway market, but their actual neighbors right there in the little town of Cherokee, Iowa. Even though by the 1970s, the farming subsidies and grants that had started happening in 1933, even though they had had a massive effect on large commercial industrial farms, there were still a bunch of farms who were heavily diversified across crop and animal products, and they were much more nimble and much more agile than the system is today. They could address the needs of the market. They could pivot if there were issues with weather or supply chain things. They could do a whole bunch of different stuff and move and build fences to make better use of the land. That's something that can't really happen today. There is a huge amount of infrastructure that has been built in Iowa. Some of it is very old, like the railway line that my great-great-grandfather worked on. And some of it is very new, like the ethanol plant, which is literally within half a mile of the farm. Almost every scrap of corn that is grown, far as the eye can see, is going to that ethanol plant. People don't eat it. It gets turned into a particularly inefficient fuel source. And there are plans for more infrastructure. There is a plan to build a pipeline that is, by the way, going to involve taking even more of our family's property, probably through eminent domain if necessary. And the plan is to build this huge pipeline that runs from ethanol plants in Iowa all the way to big underground cave areas in South Dakota. And they're going to take carbon dioxide. They're going to take carbon from the process of making ethanol, and instead of releasing it into the atmosphere, they're going to pump it hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away into these caves. So pipelines, way, way too environmentally unfriendly if they're going to be pumping fuel, highly efficient, gasoline and unrefined oil that comes out of the ground and is much, much more efficient, much more energy per gallon than ethanol. There's no way that we could sustainably build pipelines to carry fuel, but carbon dioxide, yes, we can build pipelines to carry these things. This is the kind of infrastructure that is getting built for the American agricultural system. It is not agile. It's actually incredibly brittle, and it requires that we continue doing what we're doing, trying to increase the yields on corn and soybeans for completely subsidized energy programs that in no way work without the subsidies. Now, a really interesting thing happened in New Zealand in the 1970s and 80s. New Zealand economy was very weak at that time, and New Zealand's agricultural industry was heavily subsidized like most of the Western world. But because they were running out of money and they were a small enough country that they actually thought they were going to have to deal with those consequences, they got rid of all farming subsidies, period. And then, to make it a little bit of an even trade for the farmers, they got rid of a bunch of taxes and a bunch of tariffs and a bunch of regulations. That was a pretty even exchange. And what happened was, almost overnight, the New Zealand farming industry exploded. It went from being like 4 or 5 on the actual GDP to the biggest business in the country. New Zealand agriculture is a massive chunk of the GDP now by a huge margin. And Even to this day, a tremendous amount of technological development is happening in New Zealand on the agricultural scene. I would say a disproportionately large number of new products and new processes are developed in New Zealand. And the reason is they are able to be directly influenced by the free market. They are actually able to develop tools and processes based on things that are going to be most important at that moment and not the best way to utilize a gigantic carbon pipeline that was planned 15 years ago and is going to open who knows when. So as we talk about food production, I think that's incredibly important, but we're also talking about a huge chunk of the economy that has the ability to not only feed people, which I think you'll agree is it's important. It also is an industry that has the opportunity to develop and push a whole lot of different types of technology that otherwise get really, really stagnant. And people focus on only those things that politicians want our tax dollars to pay for, not the things that we, the people, would like to pay for with their own money. One of the main takeaways, though, is just what a blessing it is to still have some family history to take the kids to. So my kids are now the sixth generation of our family that are on that farm, even if we are just visiting and looking at the artifacts. And 150 years old is really not that old. In fact, my brother Noah just visited England, and he went to a small fishing village. The last time they made major repairs to the fishing village was using timber that they salvaged from the Spanish Armada. Wreckage that was washing up on the beach. So, yeah, and in terms of actual history, 150 years is not that old. But I do want to make sure that my children understand where they came from, that they don't exist in a vacuum, that they have forebears, ancestors that came along and did very difficult things. I want them to understand the sacrifices that were made so that they can learn a little bit more about appreciating other people and the work that it takes to actually build farms and towns and civilization. I also want them to understand that our ancestors were not perfect people. I have the utmost respect for the things that my great-great-grandfather and my great-grandfather went through and the incredible difficulties that they fought through. But at the same time, my great-grandfather was actually in favor of the farm subsidies that have kind of destroyed what he wanted to preserve in the long term.
Now, do you know why stuff has changed so much in the farming world in America?
Because the government doesn't pay people for growing things except corn. So people will not grow other things. They just grow corn and soybeans.
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much what happened. And there are several reasons why that started to happen. One of them was the Great Depression. Do you know what the Great Depression was?
A huge drought in America.
Well, yes, there were a bunch of things that happened. There was a drought. There were some natural disasters. There were also some banking disasters. So people didn't have enough money. And people were very poor. The economy was not doing well. And it was hurting the farmers. And the weather was hurting the farmers. And that was when people decided that it was a good idea for the government to bail out the farmers and start to pay them to grow crops, because there wasn't enough money to buy enough food for all of the farmers to keep growing everything. And so the government started to subsidize the farmers. They started to pay them to do things that the market wasn't paying them to do. And it seemed like that was a really good idea at the time. In fact, your grandfather, Oscar, actually liked that idea. And the reason was he was seeing how hard things were for his neighbors and for him, but mostly his neighbors. There's a book, when you're older, you can read this book. It was written by a man called Studs Terkel, which is a funny name. And the name of the book is Hard Times. And it's a book about the Great Depression. And in one chapter of that book, he interviews your great-great-grandfather, Oscar. And your great-great-grandfather Oscar is crying as he remembers how hard it was for his neighbors, all the other farmers that lived around him, how difficult the Great Depression was for all of them. And so he was actually very happy when the government began to give farmers money to help farmers out. And in the short term, for the first few years, that actually seemed to really help. But did it help in the long term?
Well, I don't even know what the long term is, but I know that it didn't.
Well, in the long term, it means for the first few years, it looked like that was really helping the farmers because they had enough money to buy tools and they had enough money to buy seeds and they could grow things again and they got paid for the work that they were doing. So it looked like the problem was fixed, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of going out of business, they could stay in business. All the neighbors all around our family farm could stay in business. So it looked like the plan was working. But in the long term, this is now 80 or 90 years later, are all of those little farms still in business?
No.
No. We drove by a bunch of little farmhouses, just like the White farmhouse that you got to go inside. And a lot of them were empty. A lot of them, nobody lives in them anymore. And if you look at the area around them, you can see that they're all being farmed by some of the same great big companies. They rent the land and they grow corn and soybeans.
So I'm really grateful that I can talk about these things with my children. And as we walk around, Heidi and I are able to talk to them about different things, show them examples of what farming used to look like, compare it with what they're currently seeing, and just really build, I think, better context, historical context, and larger context in their minds as they think about these things. So, homework assignment for you today. Either do some research on the agricultural industrial complex, or dig up some of your own family history. The point isn't to find out whether or not you were related to George Washington. If you were, that's cool. But you have just as many great-great-grandparents as I do, and I think that it's really important to figure out what were the average, everyday people doing. We already know about what George Washington was up to and his contributions, but what about your great-great-grandparents? What was it that they actually did to build things, either in this country or somewhere else? What was the legacy that you are a part of? What lessons can you learn from them, either good or bad? I think that's a really important thing for us to have some level of understanding of, even if it ends up, you know, being that they're not folks that you can be particularly proud of. They're still people that you can be grateful for. And their example, whether it's good or bad, is something that you can learn from and build upon. So that's a lot of the takeaways from the most recent farm trip. I definitely want to do more of a deep dive into how American agriculture is working at the moment. I actually have some friends that I'm going to get in touch with who farm hundreds and hundreds of acres out in South Dakota, and they, to be honest, have trouble making ends meet, even farming that much land. Just wanting to do it a better way than the government wants to pay them to do requires a tremendous amount of effort, and it requires a pretty significant side hustle of buying used equipment for their own use and then refurbishing that used equipment over the winter and selling it in the spring so that they have enough to actually plant all of that land and farm it, and then with the proceeds from harvesting, buy more used equipment. That's kind of their business model, and they have to do a lot of stuff in order to just keep the lights on, to be honest. So it's kind of interesting. If we look back at my great-great-grandfather, farming in Iowa in his day was tough, and I would say that the likelihood that you were going to survive the winter much higher today than 150 years ago. But in some ways, I feel like with the current system and the way that the game is played, and maybe we should say rigged, likelihood of building a 100-year family farm that is financially successful, possibly that was easier back in his day than now. But we can work on that. There's a bunch of things that we could potentially do to change things and get farming into a healthier place. We'll just add it to the to-do list.
All right, so, Samuel, what was your favorite thing at the farm?
The tractors.
The tractors? You saw two old tractors, and you got to sit on one of them.
Yeah.
This is going to be almost an hour long. Oh, we're going to edit out a whole bunch of stuff. Don't worry.